This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about a recent report issued by the Center for Constitutional Rights. Apparently, the conditions at Guantanamo Bay Prison still violate the law.
And the same day the center issued its report, the Obama administration issued a report saying conditions were just hunky-dory at Guantanamo. It's called the Walsh Report. We call it the Whitewash Report.
We'll also hear about another report, this one issued by Amnesty International, details fresh evidence that the weapons used during the Israel-Gaza conflict earlier this year were supplied by countries abroad.
Possibly even worse, those weapons included white phosphorus, which apparently was used unlawfully in Gaza.
We'll also talk with economist Dr. Jack Rasmus, who's the financial advisor for the San Francisco Labor Council and who has an alternative socialist suggestion for how to cure the ills of this rapidly failing economy.
He'll share with us highlights from his 20-point economic recovery program. Stay with us.
Heidi, in the early 90s, I taught at Yale Law School, and there was always a big issue about this secret society called Skull and Bones. And as I vaguely recall, somebody in one of my classes was in Skull and Bones. And at that point, people started pushing me, because it was a human rights seminar, to look into, did Skull and Bones have the actual skull of Geronimo, the famous American Indian leader? Or didn't they? And if they did, could we sue them on behalf of the family? We got a little bit of distance, but we didn't get very far. It always intrigued me. People weren't sure, was it the actual skull? And the other issue was who would be really represent which family members. But now I understand we have some news some 15 years later after I was at Yale, but some exciting news about this issue.
On the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death, which was 2 weeks ago, Ramsey Clark, who's been on Law and Disorder before, has brought a lawsuit asking that the skull be returned to the family so that it can be transferred to a grave at the headquarters of the Gila River in New Mexico. And that's where Geronimo was born and where he hoped to have his remains interred. The interesting thing is, you mentioned the skull. There is a skull on display at what is called the tomb, and that's the headquarters at Yale for the Skull and Bones.
Yeah, and you can go, and you go down the street, you see this building that looks pyramid-like with no windows, out of a gray stone, and that's Skull and Bones.
In 2005, a historian actually found a letter dated in 1918 from one Skull and Bones member to another, and it said that the skull had been removed from a grave at Fort Sill. So that lends a little more credence to the theory that this might actually be Geronimo's skull.
This is about plunder, and a plunder by some Yale people, but let's keep talking about
it. And they've
been
bragging about it. I think that's part of the offense that the family has taken over all these years, that they're proud to say that they actually robbed the grave, and they took a few other things from the grave as well, a bridle and some other materials, some other bones, I think.
Now, Skull and Bones, of course, as we said, is a secret society. I think both of the President Bushes were members of it. And what's most interesting about this is there was a man named Prescott Bush, who was the current George Bush's grandfather, I think.
Yes.
Who was at Yale and who was, I think, a congressman in Connecticut or a senator. I don't recall. And he was apparently one of the grave robbers, or at least there's allegations that he was a grave robber.
So the story goes, yes. With another individual who you had a comment about.
This is about Hiram Bingham III. And I don't know if Hiram was involved in this particular.
I think he was.
Oh, yeah, in this particular.
I think he was.
It would make sense because Hiram Bingham was he's what you call an international kleptomaniac, which basically means he wants to plunder others so he can have the plunder at home. And his famous plundering, again, this is a negotiation currently going on with Yale. So just think about this for a while. Yale has in its collection a huge display and artifacts from Machu Picchu, which is the indigenous site in the Andes in Peru. And Hiram Bingham III claimed that he was the first person to discover Machu Picchu, of course, apart from indigenous people. And of course, after that discovery, he just plundered it, took the stuff back to Yale. They're not in the same room with the so-called Geronimo skull, but they're at Yale. And there's been negotiations going on now for a number of years between Peru and Yale. Yale finally offered to return a lot of the artifacts. Peru said they want them all back. So it's still going on. When you go to Machu Picchu, and I haven't been there, but apparently there's a sign saying something about Hiram Bingham plundered the artifacts
How
of Machu Picchu.
So
it's just one story, but it, of course, deeply involves the Bushes, deeply involves imperialism, deeply involves plunder, and, of course, our good friend Ramsey Clark now representing Geronimo, and we're really pleased about the fact that there was a lawsuit filed.
Yes. The conditions at Guantanamo Bay Prison still violate the law, according to an independent report released by the Center for Constitutional Rights. The report, partially compiled by attorney eyewitness accounts and detainee accounts, has found that the conditions of confinement violate Geneva Conventions and international human rights law. Among the violations are the severe isolation of solitary confinement, psychological abuse, abusive force feeding of hunger strikers, religious abuse, and physical abuse or threats of violence from guards and from the immediate reaction force team. We're joined by Pardis Cabriai, staff attorney with the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Pardis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me.
Pardis, I was pleased to see that the Center for Constitutional Rights, in a way pleased, put out a report on the same day about Guantanamo as the Obama administration did, and that report concerns whether or not the conditions at Guantanamo are compliant with Common Article 3 and other human rights instruments. And apparently, the center's position is pretty directly contrary to the Obama administration's position, which was written by some guy named Walsh. Can you give us a sense of one, what the Walsh report said, and then what you at the center and your attorneys at the center see regarding the conditions at Guantanamo now?
Sure. Walsh's team, it's Admiral Walsh, he's a member of the Navy and was assigned by the Secretary of Defense, we understand, to conduct this review. And the basic conclusion, that we haven't read the actual report, we've only read news reports and seen the transcript of his briefing. So we haven't actually read the report itself, but the basic conclusion is that the conditions at Guantanamo comport with the humane treatment requirements of the Geneva Conventions and basically comport with U.S. legal obligations in general. And that is a conclusion that we strongly object to. For one, there are serious questions about the independence of the investigation. I mean, again, the executive order that President Obama issued on January 22nd tasked the Secretary of Defense with conducting this review. So it's essentially asking the person in charge, who's been in charge of Guantanamo for a while, to investigate operations there. And it's not entirely surprising that their conclusions didn't necessarily find that the operations are not illegal.
On February 22nd, Obama signs an order saying a couple of things. Let's comply with the Geneva Conventions, or at least Common Article 3 at Guantanamo, and let's send down a team, give me a report in 30 days. And then he assigns that essentially to the Department of Defense, headed by Gates, which has been in charge of Guantanamo since the first prisoners were sent there in January 2002. So they're reporting on themselves, if I got
it, right? That's exactly right. I mean, Gates hasn't been in charge for that long, but he was in charge under the Bush administration. You know, he's the head person as the Secretary of Defense overseeing operations at Guantanamo, and he was tasked with carrying out this review. So it's more of an internal review than an outside independent one. And so, again, you know, it's not entirely surprising that they think all is fine and well at Guantanamo. The other thing is just in terms of how it was conducted, Walsh said in his briefing that they spoke with over 100 of the leadership at Guantanamo, guards, interrogators, other personnel, but only about a dozen detainees, actually. There's no further information we have at this point about, you know, exactly how many they spoke with, who they spoke with, or anything. But we do, you know, he said they only spoke with about a dozen detainees. Well, there are 240-plus detainees at Guantanamo. Why only a dozen? How representative is that group of the experience of detainees at Guantanamo? Who were they? What camps were they being held in? We take particular issue with two specific camps, which are Camps 5 and 6, which are essentially solitary confinement facilities. But there are more communal facilities at Guantanamo. You know, so were these detainees in the more communal ones, or were they in Camps 5 and 6? What were the circumstances of the interviews of these individuals? We have no further information about any of that. CCR represents almost a dozen detainees. We are co-counsel on a few dozen others, and we coordinate hundreds of habeas counsel representing the rest of the men at Guantanamo. No one we know was contacted about having their clients spoken to during this review process. So that's another major gap.
Not only none of the clients that we actually represent, but also I don't think they spoke to any of the lawyers. None of you, right?
Right. They didn't. And actually, Walsh says in his briefing that they, quote, solicited and carefully considered submissions from NGOs, concerned NGOs, and that it was very important to him to hear from NGOs. Well, the fact is that they actually contacted a handful, I think the ACLU, maybe Human Rights Watch, and then a couple of others, 24 hours before they actually wanted any submissions from anyone.
Apart from the fact that they don't really necessarily have clients there,
exactly,
those NGOs.
Exactly. So they contacted organizations, right, that do not, for the most part, directly represent detainees. The ACLU does represent some military commissions defendants, but, you know, their involvement has not been what, you know, for example, CCR's has been. And again, they were given 24 hours to turn something over. It's a bit disingenuous.
Let's go to some of the criticisms. Camps 5 and 6, and I think your press release says Camp Echo ought to be closed immediately. And
right.
What are some of the criticisms? As I recall, there's something about communication, something about isolation, some other things. What are the problems right now in those camps?
Starting with, I guess, isolation is one of the key ones. We think that there is an objective reality to what the situation is. Detainees in Camp 6 are held in cells that are 6 by 8 feet. There are no windows in those cells. They are in them for 20 to 22 hours every day. There's no openings in the cell other than a metal food slot and a window looking into the interior of the prison that allows guards to look in. The few hours that they are allowed out of their cells during, quote, so-called recreation time, which is essentially when they're taken to an outdoor cell and allowed to just kind of pace, you know, is based on compliant behavior that can be taken away based on, you know, whether detainees are acting out. You know, that's the situation of men in Camp 6. In Camp 5, it's quite similar in terms of spacing, no natural air or sunlight. The lights are on 24 hours a day. So those are some of the physical circumstances that they're being held in. The commander of the Joint Detention Group at Guantanamo, who's an individual by the name of Colonel Bruce Vargo, recently filed a declaration in one of our cases saying that solitary confinement does not exist at Guantanamo, that detainees can communicate easily with one another. Well, how do they communicate? They essentially can bend down and yell through the metal food slots in their doors, or they can lie on the floor and yell through the gap between the door and the floor. That is how detainees communicate. And that has been characterized as detainees being able to communicate easily and facilities in Camps 5 and 6 not being isolation facilities. So those are some of the ways in terms of isolation that the conclusions of Walsh's report and other authorities at Guantanamo have just been distorting the reality.
Now, what about physical abuse? Is there any of that?
Yeah, and that's actually that's an important point, because what the authorities or what camp guards and other commanders at Guantanamo say is essentially that Camps 5 and 6 are necessary for non-compliant detainees. Well, the very behavior that is deemed non-compliant is often the result of detainees' very conditions of isolation and the psychological damage that's happened to them after years of being held in conditions like this. Instead of being moved to, you know, conditions where they might have access to sunlight, might have more communal time, might be able to spend more hours outside, instead they are punished and disciplined and are moved further from the day of ever being able to leave camps like Camps 5 and 6 because of that behavior. We have a client in Camp 6. His name is Mohammed Kantumani. He was 17 when he was brought to Guantanamo. He's been in Camp 6 in isolation for at least 2 years. He was transferred with his father and has basically been held apart from his father for the entire period of his 7-year detention.
Oh, my gosh.
And he, and as far as Geneva Convention's requirements, I mean, one of the provisions requires that members of the same family be interned together, but one specific provision that absolutely is not being applied at Guantanamo. But Mohammed's condition is completely deteriorating. We went, saw him at the end of January and heard that he had tried to cut himself, his wrist, cut a vein in his wrist in late December. He's now, you know, just again completely deteriorated. He's banging his head against his cell walls. He's smearing his own excrement on his cell. And that kind of behavior is getting him subjected to serious abuse. In response recently to an incident where he was smearing feces on his cell and banging his head against the walls, there was an IRF team, which stands for, it's essentially equivalent to a riot squad that's called out on detainees when there are discipline problems. And apparently a 10-member IRF team was called to his cell, beat him up, sprayed tear gas on him, so much so that it reportedly made at least one of the guards vomit, stripped everything from his cell, and left him in a bare, soiled cell in nothing but a smock. And this is the response to someone who probably needs, you know, competent, caring psychological help. And instead, he's getting disciplined and abused and beat up.
And this was someone who was brought to Guantanamo when he was 17 years old.
Right.
I mean, it's a remarkable story of cruelty, really, when you look at it. On that issue, I know you have an incredibly busy day, but I want to move from him to something else that I know you've mentioned in your report. And again, we're speaking about the difference in the Obama administration Walsh report, what I call the White Walsh report, and the Center for Constitutional report that came out the same day regarding conditions at Guantanamo and whether they're compliant with Geneva Conventions, particularly Common Article 3 and other human rights instruments. You mentioned some of the physical abuse. There's still a hunger strike going on at Guantanamo, is that right?
There is. I was there in late January, and at the time I heard about 40, and then when I came out, there were reports of as many as 70 detainees, particularly in camps 5 and 6, and I think it started with the Yemenis, who comprise a third, a full third of men still imprisoned. So few of them have gone back, have been returned to their countries, and they are really struggling with that fact right now when they see everyone else going home and they're still there. So the Yemenis, I think, started it, and then it spread. And essentially the policy at Guantanamo, and this has been policy since early 2006 at least, has been to force feed using restraint chairs, hunger strikers. So what this process is like is that essentially detainees are those who do not want to be force-fed are forcibly extracted from their cells. They're taken to a force-feeding area. They're strapped into chairs that these chairs are manufactured by a company in Iowa, and the company calls them padded cells on wheels. And essentially, they're strapped into these chairs. Their arms, their legs, their shoulders, their heads are restrained. A 12-inch tube, which detainees describe as about the thickness of a finger, is forcibly inserted up their noses, down their throats, and into their stomachs. About a liter and a half of formula is pumped directly into their stomachs. This feeding, quote, free feeding process takes about an hour. And then to prevent detainees from regurgitating, they're left and strapped in the chairs for another hour. So one feeding process takes 2 hours of just being completely restrained in that manner, and feedings take place, you know, twice a day, and each time the tubes are removed and reinserted.
It's been going on, obviously, under the Bush administration for a great deal of time, this force feeding with the wide tubes, and many doctors and others have said, well, you can't force feed people in this situation. There's lots of controversy, but certainly everybody agrees until they're really ready to die, essentially, without going into all the complexities, so that many people look at even the idea of force feeding as a form of torture, and then, of course, the way it's done with these wide tubes. And I guess what I see around in the literature is, you know, people expected torture to end under Obama, and he said so in his recent speech to Congress that we don't torture. I just wanted your views about whether you consider this a form of torture.
We absolutely think that kind of brutal force feeding using restraint chairs is illegal. It's inhumane. It's a form of cruel and degrading treatment, at least, if not rising to the level of torture. And there are international standards and international medical organizations, for example, the World Medical Organization, which the American Medical Association is a part of, that specifically say that or prohibit force feeding in this kind of manner as a violation of doctors' ethical obligations. So we absolutely think the way it's happening now is completely brutal and does in some cases rise to the level of torture, particularly when you consider the circumstances around how these force feedings take place sometimes. And that by that I mean the way detainees are forcibly dragged out of their cells in some cases. The IRF team members, the riot squad members that I was just talking about, often are the individuals who supervise and participate in the force feedings. They're the ones who sometimes insert the tubes up detainees' noses. Often when detainees are sitting strapped with tubes in their noses being force-fed in this kind of brutal manner, there are guards standing around mocking them, humiliating them, making jokes. So there's both just the physical brutality and then the just complete, you know, inhumanity of what the whole process looks like. So in our opinion, yes, it does at least constitute cruel treatment, if not torture. And we, one of the recommendations in our report is for force feeding in that kind of manner to cease immediately, and for force feeding to only occur of individuals who might consent. I mean, there's a bit of a tension there as well, because obviously men who are on hunger strike do not want to be fed, but there are some individuals who don't mind being subjected to force feeding in a more humane manner, not being restrained, but in another manner. And I think the root problem is to look at why detainees are on hunger strike and to address some of those root issues, which go to the inhumanity of their conditions and the illegality of their detention, and to address those root causes as opposed to just forcing tubes up their noses.
Going forward, it seems to me like there's a lot that needs to be done here to push the current administration on this issue of Guantanamo, the conditions in particular that you've been addressing. Does the CCR have a website you can go to where you can actually do something?
Yes, you can go to our website, ccrjustice.org. We've got action alerts around what you can do specifically on the issue of conditions. Our report that what we were talking about and the recommendations we have are on the website, so you can read that, inform yourself, tell your community, tell your congresspeople, and just be vocal about what's. There is so much documentation, there is so much evidence. This is not an issue of we said, they said. There is an objective truth to what's going on at Guantanamo, and it's not getting out, unfortunately, even now under Obama. So there is definitely action that people can take.
Pardis, really, thank you very much. I mean, the work has really been excellent, and it was really great that you guys put out a report on the same day that the White Walsh report came out.
We agree.
Thank you, Pardis.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. Thanks so much.
Last month, Amnesty International released an in-depth report detailing fresh evidence that the weapons used during the Israel-Gaza conflict earlier this year were supplied from countries abroad. The report tracked countries that supplied arms to both Israel and Hamas. Weapons included white phosphorus, anti-tank mines, air-delivered munitions, and flechettes, 4-centimeter darts packed by the thousands into artillery shells. The report also unearthed multiple violations of humanitarian law, and in some cases, war crimes. Flechettes, for example, are not specifically banned under international humanitarian law, but they contributed to unlawful killings and injuries to civilians. According to Army medical officers, when white phosphorus comes into contact with living tissue, it can cause damage by eating away at it. The phosphorus may seep into the body and damage internal organs. In the long run, kidney failure and the spread of infection are characteristic. We are joined today by Colby Goodman, Policy Director for Military Security and Police Transfers at Amnesty International USA. Colby leads Amnesty's research and analysis on issues related to conventional arms control and child soldiers in support of Amnesty's major campaigns.
Colby, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Colby, Amnesty International just came out with, I think, a very important report on the weapons that were used in Gaza in the recent assault by both Israel and Hamas. Can you just talk about what that report is and give us some of the key conclusions?
Yeah, thanks again for inviting me. What we released last week was a preliminary briefing, more or less. It's a media briefing about all the weapons that, or a good percentage of the weapons that were used during the conflict in Gaza between the Palestinian armed groups and the Israeli military. And one of the things that we found was a lot of U.S. weapons used in very precarious situations in Gaza. In some cases, it's very clear that some U.S. weapons were used for human rights violations.
Let me ask you about that, because I think there's two things you said. One is that there were a lot of American weapons, and I guess you can tell us what they are, but two issues come to my mind. I'm sure you're familiar with one of them. One of them is the one you're saying they were misused in situations they shouldn't have been, and I'd like some talk about that. But the second one is, I remember, you know, various groups, including the Center on occasion, have written to the U.S. saying these weapons are being used for offensive reason and not for defensive. I don't know if your report gets into that, but why don't you start with the first thing on the weapons and the misuse by Israel?
The types of weapons that we found that were U.S. made that are pretty clear that have been misused by the Israeli military in Gaza. There's one case that we actually did a blog on before the report was released, and this was a case, and the Israeli military fired a Hellfire missile. which is a laser-guided missile, and we found fragments of this U.S.-made Hellfire missile right around an area where three paramedics had been killed and a boy had been killed. International humanitarian law is pretty clear about targeting and attacks on medical personnel. Pretty much, you're not supposed to do it. You're not even supposed to attack even combatants that are wounded. And what was happening at the time was there's three paramedics that were in the ambulance, and someone had told them that there were some wounded men, and they were trying to get these wounded men to take them to the hospital, and they were targeted and killed.
So that's an example of a misuse of a U.S. weapon.
Right.
That's an individual incident that may reflect broader misuse, but was there ways weapons were used in a general, more generic way that was a misuse in your view?
One of the other issues that we've talked a lot about is the use of the Israelis' use of white phosphorus munitions. Some people might know white phosphorus has a very indiscriminate or incendiary effect. It has a burning effect, and there's sort of an artillery shell, so a larger shell, and then there's all these little sort of wedges of phosphorus, and phosphorus is sort of a burning agent, and it burns at a temperature of around 1,500 degrees, and the Israeli military has been using these as smoke screens.
But what I understand is that it was used on the civilian populations quite broadly.
So what we've been saying is that Israel's use of white phosphorus and the way they're doing it in many parts of Gaza, which are densely populated, is an indiscriminate use. It goes against international humanitarian law by the way that they're using it.
The distinction is, and I know I worked on this during the Iraq War, and we never could prove it conclusively, but that white phosphorus is permitted to be used to give cover in an area because of the smoke it produces. What it can't be used on is obviously human beings are aimed like it, into the tunnels or whatever else. And what you're saying here is when white phosphorus, even assuming they were thinking of using it for screening the smoke, that when it's used over a populated area, obviously it's going to fall on people.
So I talked about the indiscriminate use of white phosphorus, and there's also the disproportionate. These are two international humanitarian law concepts. Israel's use of white phosphorus sort of breaks this too. So they're connected. So when they're using the white phosphorus munitions as smoke screen, unfortunately what's happening is a lot of the phosphorus is falling onto homes, into residential areas. And we, news accounts, and we've certainly, Amnesty researchers in Gaza, certainly talked to a lot of individuals that were injured or, families of which who had been killed by white phosphorus. And news accounts have put it around 150 that have been injured or killed by white phosphorus munitions. Most of these are civilians. And the other real problem was that Israel hadn't used white phosphorus in Gaza before. Many of the doctors that had started to see these burns, they weren't effectively trained on how to deal with these. So we talked to a young girl who, in a refugee camp, who had some of the ashes from phosphorus on her arm, and it had been like 2 weeks. But what happens is the phosphorus just sort of burns right through the skin. It's really difficult to stop it, and it'll burn right through the skin to the bone. And in some cases, because the doctors weren't didn't understand how to treat them, people were just sort of dying from relatively minor burns. Because the phosphorus can get into your system and affect your kidneys and other internal organs.
Okay, so now you've issued this report at Amnesty International, which, as I said, I think is a very significant report. What do you hope to happen, particularly on the white phosphorus issue, which was, according to what you've said, the report says it was used indiscriminately as well as violated the proportionality rules. What would you like to see happen? Do you call for something to happen?
One of the things that we've been following up on is, so Israel has used white phosphorus. Now, some of these white phosphorus munitions are not U.S.-made, and some of them are U.S.-made. There are a few cases where we've documented where Israel has used white phosphorus munitions that in situations where it's pretty clear that there was a violation. And one of the examples, we found some fragments of white phosphorus that had contributed to the burning and blowing up of a UN field operations headquarters that had a whole bunch of humanitarian supplies in there.
Do we know what companies in the U.S. make these?
Reports have indicated there's just one company, Pine Bluff Arsenal.
Is the name of the company?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. One thing we could do is put the company on notice and say that they're misusing the white phosphorus munitions, and this is a warning: if you continue to sell to a place that misuses it, you may be liable. I mean, is that a feasible strategy?
Yeah. It's Amnesty's policy, Amnesty International's policy. We have so much evidence that weapons are being misused or used for serious human rights violations that we generally call for a suspension of arms transfers until there's been a time to really investigate and to look at what's happened. This is something that our global movement has been calling for. One of the things that we in the U.S. have been urging the Department of State to do is to investigate potential violations of the Arms Export Control Act, the U.S. law that regulates how foreign countries can use U.S. weapons.
How do we get to the report? How do our listeners look at even the briefing? Where do we go?
Right. So check out www.amnestyusa.org. On our website, we have the briefing, and we have information on our blogs about other cases. And one of the things that people can do if they're interested or they're really concerned about this is they can join our effort to push the U.S. government to investigate what happened with U.S. weapons in Gaza.
Well, thank you, Colby. I mean, I think it's great that AI did this, and I appreciate your coming on the show.
Great.
Thank you, Colby.
So
visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Close by, someone murdered. Nobody seen, nobody heard it. Just another funeral service. We'll get at you. Come through shining, they at you. In broad daylight, kidnap you. Best get clapped through. Police stay on us like tattoos. Looking only grind cause we have to. Money is power. Sling powder. Fiends come through every hour. It's all about that dollar. And we no deal with cowards. Weak lamb get devoured by the lion in a concrete jungle. The strong stand.
There are economic solutions and proposals that are alternatives to or critical of the $787 billion economic stimulus plan of the Obama administration. Dr. Jack Rasmus's recent article in Z Magazine, titled Obama's Economic Plan Versus an Alternative, lays out a different recovery program in 20 measures that could stimulate job growth, run an alternative tax plan, and push through a single-payer health plan. His Z Magazine article is a snapshot from his newly published book titled Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. Author and Professor Jack Rasmus teaches in the Department of Economics and Politics at St. Mary's College, California. Jack Rasmus, welcome to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
The cover of Newsweek magazine, it reads, "We are all socialists now," with a blue and red hand shaken. And it says, "The perils and promise of the new era of big government." Evidently, they assume that given money to the financial bankers without any kind of control over it is socialism. Tell me, if you were to give a headline about what happened with first the Bush bailout and then Obama's proposed plan, how would you describe it?
Well, just to sort of describe perhaps one more phrase, their concept of socialism, it must be to each according to his balance sheet, from each according to his portfolio, perhaps.
From us to them.
Yes. Well, it really is all about bailout. Banks come first, trickle down. Maybe they'll give something to the rest of us, which they don't. We've seen a virtual banker's strike for the last 6 months. We've thrown somewhere between $2 and $3 trillion at the banks, with the hope that they'll loan a little bit out at a little lower interest rate. And, of course, they're not doing that. We know they're paying each other big bonuses and dividends and acquiring each other and so forth. The major big banking system, the commercial money center banks, are pretty much in default, pretty much broke. And they're zombie banks, as they say. They're banks in name only. They're not really acting as banks. The problem has been the strategy of the Federal Reserve and the Bush administration, and now we even see some indications of that continuing under Obama, is that throw more money at the banks and hopefully they'll respond. In other words, it's a liquidity crisis. They just don't have enough money to lend. Well, actually, it's a solvency crisis. They're broke. We saw in 2008 the bust-up of the investment banking model with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and others. That model is gone, and I think this year we're going to see the bust-up of the commercial banking, money center banking system. And the other shoe is about to fall now that the banking crisis has really accelerated globally, and will have a feedback effect on the U.S. banks here. A solvency crisis means they're really in default, and they're not going to loan, and throwing all the money at them isn't going to, at their balance sheet, isn't going to work. We've been throwing that money, and the hole in their balance sheet has kept opening up wider, and we kept throwing more money into it. The problem is the collapse of asset prices, particular housing asset prices. Until you do something about the foreclosures and millions of people providing excess supply on the market of homes, you know, we're going to have 5 to 7 million in foreclosure before this cycle is over. You're not going to stop this because it's the collapse of housing prices that spill over to the collapse of equity prices and spill over to all other short-term credit markets and their prices. And now asset price collapse is bleeding over into product prices and labor market prices, wages. So we're on the verge here and have already entered a deflationary spiral, which feeds back on the crisis and will cause massive corporate defaults. Even Moody's Service is predicting we're going to go from about 3% corporate defaults, I'm talking about non-financial, to at least 15% here. We're going to see some very big-name companies go under, including auto companies, I predict, and that's going to cause another round of financial system stress. I've been saying with my concept of epic recession, in other words, not a normal recession, not yet a depression, but an unstable, hybrid kind of a condition, which can't maintain that instability, has to either be contained back to a normal recession or has to develop into a full-blown global depression in the classic sense. We're in that phase now, epic recession. In fact, my book coming out is called Epic Recession and the Global Financial Crisis. This is really a junctural year, 2009. Either the Obama program in its various parts is going to be able to slow and check this, contain it, or we're going to find ourselves, if the Obama program is too little too late, transitioning next year, 2010, into a true global depression. And I think we're sort of gaining momentum in that direction. I'm not predicting it's inevitable, but I'm saying we're we're coming to the 50-50 mark, I think, at least with regard to that. My view of the Obama program is too little too late.
Yeah, that's my view too, Jack. I would like you to please do two things for us. We're speaking with Dr. Jack Rasmus, who's an economist out in California. I understand that the alternative program that you've suggested has been adopted almost in whole by the San Francisco Labor Council. And what I'd like you to do, if you could, is explain why you think the Obama program is too little too late and what kind of alternative with people with our point of view and our values put up in competition to what seems to me just to be throwing money at the banks.
Right. Yes, I am the economic advisor to their Economic Recovery Committee, and they've recently developed a 18-point program. My program is 20 points. There's just a couple that they didn't feel politically they could adopt, and they are communicating, the San Francisco Labor Council, communicating this program to other central labor councils in California and elsewhere. But having said that, what is the Obama recovery program? Well, there's really three parts to this program. One is the stimulus bill that's getting a lot of attention, the $789 billion of tax cuts and spending. And then there is the big bank bailout, which has two parts. One, what to do about the bad assets of these big banks, the commercial banks, Citigroups and Wells Fargo's and Bank of America's. And then a plan also to try to resurrect what's called the securitized markets, auto, credit cards, student loans, commercial property, and so forth. So the bank bailout is kind of a two-part thing. And then thirdly, what are they going to do about the housing industry and mortgage modification? So we can take each one of those. First of all, the what is the $789 billion stimulus plan? What is it? Well, first of all, it's not a plan to really restore jobs. This is not a jobs plan. You know, we've lost, as my estimations have been in recent published articles, we've lost, since the recession began in December 2007, we started with 7 million unemployed. We are somewhere around 13 million unemployed. Officially, the government will admit to about 3 million additional unemployed over the past year, but, you know, they're not counting the massive amount of jobs that have been converted from full-time to part-time. Over 6 million jobs have been converted in addition to the 3 million jobs that have officially been lost, and they're not properly calculating discouraged workers and other workers who want a job who just aren't collecting unemployment insurance anymore. So really, we got about 5 to 6 million additional new unemployed, gives us about 13 million, and I predict the rate that the jobless claims are going, we're going to have another 5, 6, 7 million maybe unemployed this year. And even Obama indicates that, well, it's not, his program isn't going to have much effect on unemployment this year. So we could be seeing at the end of the year with 20 million unemployed, massive number of unemployed. This stimulus program is not really designed to reverse that massive unemployment, which is gaining momentum. At first, Obama said it would be 3 to 4, 3, 3.5 million jobs created. But now he's saying, well, it's 3, 3.5 million may be saved as well as created. In other words, they'll be able to argue even if we have 5 million jobs new unemployed, well, there would have been 8 million if we hadn't the stimulus program. But if you look at the program, what it is designed to do is to slow the accelerating collapse of consumption going on in this country. You know, the payroll tax rebate and some other programs are designed to try to put consumers a little bit more money in consumers' pocket to slow down the collapse. But the collapse is being driven, the consumption collapse, by the massive job losses. If you look at 10 million new unemployed over the course of 2 years here, last year and this year, that means we're losing $400 billion in consumption just from the unemployed. And then you got to add in the effects on consumption from the asset price collapse, and it was housing values collapsing, 401ks collapsing, stocks collapsing. You got to add in credit cost increase. Credit cards are being cut off. Long-term rates are rising. The reduction in hours worked occurring, state and local tax and fee increases, and the cut in state and local government spending. Well, when you do that, it's pretty clear that even as an attempt to slow down the collapse of consumption, it's only partially doing so, not nearly enough to slow down the consumption collapse, which is driving the whole downward spiral here right now.
And what about the big bank bailout? What's that going to do?
Well, that's a good question. The big bank bailout is really more of the same. It's really a way of throwing more money at the banks themselves in a little bit of different form. They're proposing to set up some kind of an insurance scheme to back up the banks. In other words, instead of giving them direct money, they'll insure them in case they do collapse. We saw that with Citigroup. Citigroup is actually a bank that's been default technically for some time. It's got over $1 trillion in off-balance sheets liabilities. The government back in November said, you know, they will support, in terms of insurance, up to $300 billion for Citigroup. Well, they're taking the Citigroup plan and they're trying to generalize it. And what's really amazing about the bank bailout is that they're proposing that if they throw several hundred billion dollars more at the banks, the big banks, commercial banks, then they'll be able to raise capital and bring other kinds of capital, private capital, in to the tune of $2 trillion. I just don't believe that's going to happen. Private investors aren't going to throw $1.5 trillion to match the government's half a trillion, because they know they're technically bankrupt, and you know there's no way they can make money on investing in these banks anymore. So I think that whole plan is going to pretty much fail.
And Jack Rasmus, let me get on to the third point you were making and remind listeners to Law and Disorder that we're talking with Dr. Jack Rasmus, an economist in California and the advisor to the San Francisco Labor Council. Jack, you talked the third point you made about the overall problem in terms of how the Obama big bank supporters are handling it, is the housing crisis. What are they doing with that?
I think it'll be more of the same once again, insofar as the whole approach, the dabbling at the house, solving the housing crisis before Obama, led by the Federal Reserve, was really how to subsidize the lenders and to get them hopefully to lower rates a little bit to home buyers. The Federal Reserve has been through the GSEs, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and government-owned AIG now, been trying to buy up these assets, housing assets, and throwing some money at it. They've got $600 billion that they're going to throw at it, trying to. They haven't expended it all. But basically what it is, a plan to say, okay, lenders and mortgage people, we're going to subsidize you. In other words, we're going to give you taxpayer money if you lower interest rates and renegotiate some of the principal with some of these people who are facing foreclosures and others who are now losing their jobs and beginning to walk away. It's a trickle-down approach. In other words, once again, kind of like the banks, give the mortgage lenders money, and hopefully they'll stop going on strike and they'll lower their interest rates.
Let's talk about the approach that you would recommend to people who are members of the San Francisco Labor Council. Let's talk about approach not that supports capitalists in a trickle-down, but that supports people who work for a living on the bottom. What would you suggest?
Well, what I've suggested is there's no real way out of this housing crisis without nationalizing the residential mortgage markets. And I don't mean a Greenspan definition of nationalization where you prop up the investors until the recovery occurs, then you spin off and sell these things to private interests again. That's what they mean by nationalization.
Exactly.
But I'm talking about where the government does what it did in the 1930s, by the way. The only solution is to create a new government agency and properly fund it. And I've estimated in my program that I sent to the House Finance Committee, it would take about $900 billion to $1 trillion to really resolve the housing crisis. And what we would do is essentially the government create a small residential mortgage and small business loan agency and go in there and reduce the principal and the interests to long-term averages that existed before 2002-2007 run-up, where we had this huge speculation. And that would cover all loans, not just those that are in possible foreclosure or default. This would be a plan that would stimulate consumption, not just solve the housing industry and do it in a way that wouldn't exacerbate the federal budget deficit. And this agency would go in, of course, and buy up these loans from the mortgages and the lenders and pay them 50 cents on the dollar, 25 cents immediately, and the other 25 cents over the 30-year term of these mortgages. So they, you know, the lenders would get something as an incentive, but then the mortgages would no longer be in a private sector, and the government, through this agency, would actually be the mortgage lender going forward. This is kind of what we did in the 1930s. We created what was called the Homeowners Loan Corporation. The government went in there and said, okay, all you mortgage lenders who are essentially defunct and won't loan to residential mortgage buyers, okay, you're out of business. You're going to merge with this guy over here. And they sort of made decisions, and the weak lenders were thrown overboard, and the others that had a chance were merged and consolidated. And at the same time, the government went in with the Homeowners Loan Corporation and actually helped each individual homeowner lower their principal and lower their interest. Banks are getting 0% loans. Why can't the homeowners at least get the loans of 1 or 2%? I mean, it's doable.
Yeah, exactly. What would you do with respect to job retention and job creation, reversing the whole loss of manufacturing jobs in this country?
Yes, well, the other big problem with the Obama stimulus program, like I say, is it's not really a jobs recovery program. And that's the key. That's the key to the consumption collapse and the downward spiral that we're in right now. And the key to restoring that is to restore these jobs. We need a much more massive jobs program, larger not only in magnitude, but also in terms of its composition. And my program, for example, calls for spending of $1 trillion over the next 2 years on a very comprehensive distributed jobs creation and retention program, $300 billion to state and local government and schools. We can create jobs quickly there. Another $100 billion dedicated to those industries where we've had pretty good job creation, like healthcare and so forth. Another $125 billion is going to cost to resurrect manufacturing in this country. It's going to take probably another $100 billion plus in terms of unemployment insurance, food stamps, and Medicaid and so forth. And then we're going to have to make some decisions on the auto companies. It's going to take another $50 to $75 billion to bail out these auto companies, but they have to be nationalized. They have to be consolidated. You just can't have three auto companies surviving, U.S. auto companies, going forward. And they have to be nationalized if we're going to put that much government money into them. We don't give them a penny unless they stop their investments and expansions overseas. You know, Ford's building big plants in Petersburg, Russia, and GM's building big plants in Shanghai. Well, they got to stop that immediately because taxpayers shouldn't subsidize that. You know, immediately they should be required to build cars with proper mileage, and we should have government and community and union representation on their boards of directors going forward. And until they do those three things, I wouldn't give them a penny. They have to be consolidated, and they have to be nationalized if you're going to give them that much money.
We're speaking with Dr. Jack Rasmus. He's a professor of economics out in California. He's written a new book, important book, called Epic Recession and Global Financial Crises. He also has an article in this month's Z Magazine. If you had to say it in a nutshell, as opposed to the kind of finance capital help that the Obama administration has embarked on, what would you call a socialist program for economic recovery?
Well, a socialist program is, does it help society? In other words, does it help a broad base of people, not just, you know, the top tier of the elite, particularly the banking elite, the financial elite, or even the corporate elite? Nationalization in whose interest? Who's going to benefit from this? This is the key, you know, and is it broad-based benefit? My proposal to nationalize the residential mortgage and small business property market is clearly designed to benefit the homeowner and the small business owner. And the mortgage lenders are going to take the loss. It's very simple to see who takes the loss and who takes the benefit. Nationalization has many faces. The question is, whose face is being taken care of here?
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that was the misdirection of this Newsweek cover when it says, "We are all socialists now," and it has a red hand shaking a blue hand, and it says, "The perils and promise of the new era of big government." Well, we're not talking about a big government helping big capitalists. Not in your program, Jack Rasmus. We're talking about something entirely different, aren't we?
Correct. What they're talking about when they say socialism is socialize the cost and privatize the profits.
Exactly.
That's, you know, they've got it turned on its head, and they call that socialism. Well, it's socialism for the super rich, mega rich. It's not socialism. I mean, it's an oxymoron because socialism means society. How is society at large maximizing its benefit is the question. And, of course, most of society are working and middle-class folks. How are they benefiting from this? You know, is the homeowner benefiting? Part of this housing Obama and Bush housing mortgage plan, by the way, is to let the poor homeowner go into foreclosure and then lower the interest rates for the new buyers. So they're willing to throw people in stress right now, you know, over the transom and good luck, swim if you can, rather than trying to help and bail out the people who are in trouble. And that's the big difference between my plan. And by the way, my $2 trillion plan would be financed by rolling back all capital income tax cuts back to 1980. It has to go back to 1980, not 1993, because the big tax cuts occurred under Reagan and the first Bush, and of course the second Bush to the tune of $4 trillion. And the other proposal I have is let's bring back at least $2 trillion of the $6 trillion that's been stuffed in offshore tax havens and tax shelters over the last 20 years. You know, even Morgan Stanley Investment Bank estimated in the 1980s there was $250 billion in these offshore tax shelters, 27 island nations, Cayman Islands, Vanuatu, Seychelles, etc. Well, now they estimate there's over $6 trillion. Well, that's where all the wealthy you know, individual investors and corporations stuffed all the money that they've accumulated for themselves. Well, let's just bring just a couple trillion of that back. I'm not saying expropriate them, but they can bring it back and put it in the banking system, and that would provide the liquidity for the banks. And that's exactly what Germany is doing. They, you know, German investors stuffed their winnings here in Liechtenstein, little island, not island, but little mountain country in Austria. Last year, the German government, you know, just by chance, got hold of a laptop that had all the names of these investors who were stuffing their money in Liechtenstein, and they went after them. Well, why can't we go after them, too? Yeah, we could have really had the will and wanted to do it. And then there's other means, too, for financing this that are quite possible, quite realistic. But it means those people who have been gorging themselves in the last 2.5 decades are going to have to start paying their fair share.
Jack Rasmus, it's really an enlightening pleasure to talk to you. You're an economist with his head screwed on straight. Let me give our listeners your website again so people can look up your writings. It's called kykloss.com. That's spelled K-Y-K-L-O-S productions.com. They can check out your article in Z Magazine on your economic recovery plan, one that was proposed and accepted by the San Francisco Labor Council. And it's a plan that really is the opposite of the plan that the big bankers and the Republican and Democratic Party are fiddling with now. We appreciate your being on the show. Best of luck to you with your new book, Epic Recession and Global Financial Crisis. Dr. Jack Rasmus, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.